Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc Forum in which we'll be discussing the question, does JARCISI doom the Preserve Access to Affordable Generics and Biosimilars Act? Speaking on the panel today, we have Matt Hellman, Willie Jay, and Professor Emily Morris. Joining us as our moderator today is Brian Pandya, who is a partner at Duane Morris and a co-chair of the Intellectual Property Practice Group here at the Federalist Society. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Brian, thank you for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Great. Well, thank you, Edith, and good morning to everyone who is with us today on the panel. I'm excited about today's discussion because it's rare that we get a chance to talk about patent law, antitrust law, and administrative law in one session. But there's legislation that's working its way through Congress, the Preserving Access to Affordable Generics and Biologics Act, that some people think may actually get some traction during the lame duck session, that raises all three of those issues. Now, I'm assuming if you're on today's webinar, you have some familiarity with the Hatch-Waxman Act, with the BPCI Act, both of the acts that govern how generic drugs or how biosimilars can enter the market. If not, let me just give a quick summary, is that the way that it works is that before a generic or biosimilar product enters the market, a party, a generic or a biosimilar maker, can go through a patent litigation that's initiated by the branded drug company or by the innovator. And if the generic succeeds in invalidating the patent or showing non-infringement, then the generic drug can launch onto the market. So it's an expedited way to bring generics and biosimilars to the market. Of course, there's a bit of regulatory nuance, but in a nutshell, that is what happens. Now, the problem is that in this situation, there often can be settlements that a lot of people say are pro-competitive and ultimately allow faster entry of generic products to market. Other people have argued that these settlements actually are anti-competitive and delay generic or biosimilar competition on the market. One of the things that Congress now is proposing, and this has been an issue that has really been around for as long as I have been working on these cases, and I suspect for as long as all of us on this panel have been dealing with this issue, is what authority does the FTC have to bring these actions? The legislation that's proposed today sets up a new way of investigating these actions, and that raises a whole host of issues that we are going to get into. But so to set the table, I'm going to turn the floor over to Professor Emily Morris, who will tell us a little bit about set the table on what are some of the issues on how and why settlements arise in this space, and what are the antitrust implications, and what is the FTC doing in this area? So before I do that, I will again just echo Edith's comment that we are all here speaking in our individual capacities. Anything we say should not be attributed to our law firms or our clients or our universities. And furthermore, I mean, if this was an in-person session, it would be Chatham House rules, but the same concept applies. I'm gonna throw some hypotheticals out. There's going to be a bit of play acting just for the sake of debate, which is what makes a Federalist Society panel a Federalist Society panel. So don't, you know, take what we say seriously, but not literally today, because it should not be attributed to any of us individually or our clients, firms, universities. So, Professor Morris.
Thanks, Brian. As Brian mentioned, I'm going to lay some of the groundwork, give you some of the facts that give rise to this particular legislative proposal, and will help you understand the impact of the legislative proposal, but also whether or not it is in fact necessary. So among the many ways in which pharmaceutical patents are treated differently than those in any other technology, one important difference is how the so-called small molecule drugs, and that's what's covered by the Hatch-Waxman Act, are litigated under what is popularly known as the Hatch-Waxman Act, which was enacted back in 1984. So specifically, the Hatch-Waxman Act provides generic manufacturers with a risk-free and often quite lucrative pathway to challenge patents on the drugs that they want to copy. So first off, the Hatch-Waxman Act gives generics special standing to sue and be sued for potential patent infringement. All a generic needs to do is nothing more than file an application with the FDA for marketing approval. This saves the generic from launching at risk, basically from launching their generic and facing potentially millions of dollars in potential infringement liability, as well as the loss of any investments that they made in actually infringing and bringing their drug to the market. And these are all risks that other patent infringement defendants face in patent infringement litigation, but these are all risks that the generics do not have to face under the Hatch-Waxman Act. And second, the first to file a generic to apply to the FDA for approval can enjoy 180 days of exclusivity as the only generic on the market, should they be successful in challenging one of more of the patents on the drug at issue. Although this doesn't sound like much, this 180-day exclusivity can, in some situations, be worth hundreds of millions or billions of dollars even in duopoly or even oligopoly profits. So in bringing these challenges, small molecule generic manufacturers have nothing to lose and everything to gain in challenging drug patents, even if their chances of actually succeeding in challenging the validity of these patents is quite small. Generics, therefore, have no reason to want to settle these patent infringement suits unless they can extract something of value from the brand name patent holders. The brand name pharmaceutical patent holders, by contrast, have everything to lose. Patents are extremely important in the pharmaceutical industry, and indeed, pharmaceuticals are the one industry in which we think the patent system actually works. Part of the problem is that brand name manufacturers obviously have to get FDA approval to market their drugs, and this requires years and millions to billions of dollars in research and development, clinical trials, and so on. So the brand name manufacturers see patents as vital in protecting their investments in research and development. Generic manufacturers, by contrast, do not have to make any such investments, in part because they're simply copying the drugs invented by others, but also because generics now no longer have to invest in clinical trials themselves. They can instead rely on the clinical trials testing done by the brand name manufacturer. And in fact, thanks to what are now automatic substitution laws and policies by insurers, generics don't even have to market or detail their drugs. They can rely on the marketing and detailing done by the brand name manufacturers. And this is all to help generic manufacturers sell their versions of drugs at pennies to the dollar compared to brand name manufacturers. So as a result, even a small chance that a generic could invalidate a patent and enter the market earlier than expected could mean billions of dollars of losses in revenue for brand name manufacturers. This has led to what is at the heart of the Preserve Access Act. So this has led to what are called reverse payment settlements, in which the brand name patent holders agree to give the generic patent challengers payments or other transfers of value. These transfers themselves can total millions or even billions of dollars in some cases, depending on how much the brand name patent holder stands to lose. Both the size and the direction of these settlement payments have caught the eyes of critics, who argue that these settlements are merely efforts by brand name manufacturers to keep generics off the market. The critics therefore dub these settlements as pay-for-delay agreements and argue that they violate antitrust laws as agreements that restrain competition in the small molecule drug market and help to keep drug prices high. In the first antitrust lawsuit against one such reverse payment settlement, the Sixth Circuit held that the settlement was per se illegal under antitrust law. A number of other courts, however, subsequently held that as long as the settlement covered only the patent at issue and only the drug that was covered by the patent, it was within the scope of the patent and therefore legal because it was protected by the patent rights that the brand name manufacturers held. The issue eventually percolated up to the United States Supreme Court in 2013. In a case called FTC versus Actavis. There, the majority opinion effectively sided with the critics. Although the court refused to hold that reverse payment settlements were per se illegal under the Hatch-Waxman Act and under antitrust law, they did hold that any transfer of value beyond the generic challenger's litigation costs would have to be justified basically as legitimate ancillary agreements for services or products or something else other than what the critics view as payment for the generic to stay out of the market. And so this brings up the Preserve Access Act, which was actually introduced back in 2006. When Senator Herb Kohl first introduced it, a lot has happened since then, of course, and in particular, the Supreme Court has weighed in fairly definitively in its 2013 decision in FTC versus Actavis. So for those of us who are who study the patent system, and in particular the pharmaceutical industry and its use of patents, this raises the question of whether or not the preserve access is even relevant anymore. But before we get to that, I'll hand it back to Brian so he can get a little bit more insight on the Preserve Access Act.
Great. Well, thank you, Emily, for that great summary of the Hatch-Waxman and the biologics system. I do want to come back to a couple of the assertions you made about, you know, the risk sharing, because I think that is relevant to the antitrust analysis. But before we go there, I think I want to pick up on a point. You raised a great point that the Preserve Access Act, there have been various versions of this legislation floating around since, as you said, 2006, so almost 18 plus years. So it's almost old enough to vote now. But we're going to focus on the current version that was introduced in 2023, sponsored by Senator Klobuchar, who I think, regardless of our political views, I think we all recognize she's a very thoughtful and serious senator, especially on competition issues, co-sponsored by Senator Grassley, another very serious and respected member of the Senate, and has bipartisan support of about 10 other senators. And I think there's a couple aspects I'll mention about this bill. Number one, that creates a presumption that what you dub reverse payment settlements are presumptively anti-competitive unless you can show a pro-competitive purpose. There's also a few carve-outs unless it's clearly tied to legal fees, or you can point to some other rationale. And I think that's an important point that we'll come back to. I mean, for example, I mean, I think the assumption here is that you only settle when you're going to lose a patent case. But I think we all know that finding and invalidating a patent is difficult. Getting a non-infringement verdict is difficult. But we'll come back to that. That's one aspect of it. But there's another aspect of it is that it empowers the Federal Trade Commission to conduct its own investigations, to conduct its own ALJ proceedings specifically in the space, which, you know, may sound like a technocratic and efficient idea, but I think there's problems with that. And the Supreme Court actually weighed in on another case that's in the title of our program, Jarczy. So I'm going to turn that over to Matt Hellman to explain both generally what the Supreme Court said specifically what the Supreme Court said in Jarczy, but if you can also tell us a little about the history of agency adjudication and how that plays into the act here.
Thanks so much, Brian. And it's a pleasure to be with you all today. So it's a Federal Society webinar. I have to assume it's not the first time Jarczy has been mentioned over the last few months for most of you. So I won't give you too much detail, but for those who are in need of a refresher, Jarczy is a case that the court decided this past term, and it's one in a series of cases in which the court has pretty dramatically pulled back on agency discretion and agency power. I think everyone knows about Loper-Bright, which talks about whether or not a court needs to defer to an agency interpretation of a statute. Jarczy is about a different set of questions, which is when and under what circumstances can an agency enforcer use not an Article III court, but the agency's own administrative tribunal to determine liability and impose a remedy. And Jarkissi considered an enforcement action that the SEC brought for securities fraud. Now, the SEC has the choice. It can litigate in Article III courts. It can bring an action in federal district court, or it can litigate in front of its own enforcement authority in front of an ALJ within the SEC. Historically, the SEC had, probably to the surprise of a few, you know, preferred to litigate in that forum, although recently maybe seen the writing on the wall. They actually had been going to federal court a little more often. But what the Supreme Court, Jarkissi had been sued in the agency court and was litigating his liability. And he challenged the constitutionality of this agency enforcement scheme, saying that the SEC was seeking civil penalties, a monetary payment for him, and indeed a punitive one. And he had a Seventh Amendment right to have a jury decide whether or not he owed money to the plaintiff in the case, the United States. And the case went up through the Fifth Circuit, which found in his favor on that issue and others. And the Supreme Court, when it came to the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice ended up writing the opinion for, I believe, six justices. And he held a couple of things. He held the bottom line, of course, being that it did violate Jarkissi's Seventh Amendment rights to have the agency and not a jury determine his make him pay money damages in the form of a civil penalty. And the chief explained it in the following way. He proposed this framework. First question is the suit that the government is bringing legal in nature? Does it look like a common law cause of action? And here it's a fraud action, securities fraud to be sure, but a fraud action. And so, and not only that, it's for civil penalties for dollars. And the chief said, the parallels to historic common law fraud actions are very strong in this case. And the civil penalties aren't designed merely to compensate. They're designed to punish and deter. This looks like the kind of thing that a jury would otherwise be required under the Seventh Amendment. And then the chief turned to really the exception, which I think in the majority's view had been swallowing the rule in recent times, which is sure, everybody understood that these kinds of fraud suits looked a little bit like common law fraud claims. But ultimately, what was being vindicated was not some sort of private court right or the right to be free from fraud, but a federal scheme. The securities law is complicated. Securities fraud is complicated. And it's all created by federal statute. And so what the chief explained was there is something called the public rights exception to the Seventh Amendment, which does allow for in the case of certain kinds of public rights, for those to be litigated in agency tribunals and not in front of a jury. But the chief said that doctrine had been expanding, metastasizing beyond its proper limits. It's really not in the Constitution in some clear way. And he said we have to be careful that the doctrine doesn't expand beyond true public rights. And, he said it's a little, the line is fuzzy. It's not always easy to draw. But if we're not talking about things like tax collection, the administration of public lands, public pensions, for example. And he also talked a little bit about patent rights as well, which is something that we can talk about. He said, absent sort of those well-defined areas, public rights need to be seen more narrowly than that. Justice Sotomayor in the dissent said, here, the government is the plaintiff. The government is suing under a federal scheme. It doesn't get more public right-like than that. But that was the minority opinion. That was the dissent. There were three justices for that position. There were six who signed on to the chief's opinion. And so What that means going forward is if you happen to be aware of any agency enforcement scheme that allows for civil penalties, and we'll talk about one that's in the act here today, there's a big question as to whether or not that is allowed anymore after the SEC opinion, the opinion striking down the SEC enforcement scheme in Jarkissi. So, you know, maybe this is, Brian, I can turn it back to you. I don't know if you want to pick it up from there, but I think Jarkissi is the lens through which we need to understand and assess what's going on with the PROTECTS Act.
Yeah. And so let me from here call on Willie to ask, can you, so looking through the lens of Jarkissi, maybe explain explain the adjudication system that's set up, that there's purports to be set up in the Preserve Access Act, and kind of looking at it through the Jarkissi lens, do you see a problem here, or does this fall into the public rights exception, or is this an equitable regime? I know some people argue the FTC's authority is equitable, not based in law, so the Seventh Amendment concerns are more attenuated. But can you analyze this through the Jarkissi mm-hmm. framework? Then maybe we'll come back to you, Matt, to respond to what Willie has to say.
Sure. And thanks, Brian. And thanks, everyone, for being here. The short answer is this slices the adjudication into two pieces, but it is still a way for the agency to pursue civil penalties. And I think that if that's the, as Matt said, if we're looking through the lens of Jarkissi, the fact that the civil penalties come in a second proceeding, I think doesn't make any real difference. So let me walk you through how the framework in this legislation would work. So you have the Federal Trade Commission, which is structured just like the SEC and has ALJs just like the SEC, and gets reviewed, or ALJ decisions get reviewed just like the ALJ decisions in Jarkissi. So ALJ makes a decision, the politically appointed Senate-confirmed commissioners review it, and then it can go to a court of appeals, not a trial court, for a deferential form of review, which the Supreme Court has characterized as even more deferential to the fact finder than appellate courts are to district courts when the district courts find facts. If the commission thinks that a settlement agreement is something that it wants to challenge, this legislation gives it the benefit of a presumption that that if there's value exchanged, and there's a detailed definition of what counts for that. That's kind of, we could spend a whole webinar on that. There's a presumption that it's anti-competitive. And so the settling parties basically have to prove that they're settlement had a pro-competitive justification. They have to do that by clear and convincing evidence. And so they have to do that in the same tribunal that is staffed by the commission, the same commission that will have voted to bring the proceeding and that appointed the ALJ and appointed the general counsel who will be litigating the proceeding against the settling parties. So the part before the ALJ is styled as a cease and desist proceeding. So in other words, it would result in an order that says, this is anti-competitive, stop doing that. And so far, we haven't gotten to the civil penalties that are the trigger under Jarkissi. But once the civil penalty, once the cease and desist proceeding is done, then the commission has the ability to go to federal court and seek a civil penalty. And in that civil penalty action, the district court has basically nothing to do except determine the amount of the penalty. Because if there's been a cease and desist proceeding, this legislation says that all of the factual findings made by the commission as to any material facts shall be conclusive. So in other words, you won't be able to argue if the FTC has rejected your pro-competitive justification, you won't be able to argue that it is pro-competitive in the civil penalty proceeding. You won't be you may not be able to argue about the key fact that is relevant to the civil penalty, which is the penalty can be up to three times the value received by the party that is reasonably attributable to the violation. So in deciding whether the statute is triggered, the commission is going to decide what kind of value is exchanged or received. And so that finding is likely to be conclusive in the on the district court for setting the ceiling for the penalty. Now, that does leave the district court discretion over how much with, you know, up to that ceiling to impose as a penalty. Now, you might think, okay, well, that's going to go to a jury, right? But the Supreme Court decided in sort of the back end of a decision called Tull versus United States in the 80s, that the although a civil penalty is the kind of thing that triggers the Seventh Amendment when the government pursues it, the amount of the civil penalty is not something that triggers a jury right. So in other words, the jury might have to find you liable, but it's okay for the judge to decide where underneath the cap to set the penalty. That, I think it is fair to say, that was a somewhat under-explained part of the decision in Tull. And it basically just said, well, at the founding, the amount was generally set by statute. And Justice Scalia, joined by Justice Stevens, you know, something of an odd couple, right, in dissent, observed, just saying that that Congress could set the penalty by statute does not answer the question of who should decide what it will be if Congress instead sets a cap and not a flat penalty. It's one thing to say you can sue for a civil penalty of $100. It's quite another to say the penalty shall be anywhere from zero to $10 billion, or whatever treble the amount is. So the bottom line is, under this framework, the judge, the Article III judge who hears the civil penalty action, is going to have very little to do. Violation is probably going to be already baked. It will have been determined by the agency and reviewed only deferentially by a court of appeals. And although the judge can set the penalty, that the Supreme Court has said that it doesn't have to enlist a jury in picking that number. And anything that a jury might do is probably already going to be done. So the question is, looking at this through the lens of jargassy, does the fact that you have an Article III judge come in at the end of the process change the way we look at this for Seventh Amendment purposes? And I would argue that the answer is no, that if this is a cause of action for civil penalties, it is one that should be treated the same way as in jargassy. And the fact that the agency has basically been allowed to, I'm going to say this somewhat tendentiously, stack the deck on the front end in the agency adjudication means that you're not really getting an Article III adjudication, and you certainly are never getting an adjudication compliant with the Seventh Amendment, because nowhere in the ALJ, the FTC, the Court of Appeals, or the District Court are you getting a jury. I'm going to add one more thing that I think makes this slightly more problematic than even the average bear, which is that historically, when one of the independent agencies, and I use that in shutter quotes, has pursued civil penalties, Congress has recognized that that's enforcing federal law. That's traditionally an executive branch function, and it ought to be done by officials of the Department of Justice who are responsible to the Attorney General and ultimately the president. So most agencies, when they pursue civil penalties, have to refer civil penalty actions to the Attorney General. The FTC has chipped away at that, and in most of its work, it just has to ask the Attorney General to do it. But if the Attorney General says no, then the FTC can do it itself. This legislation would allow the FTC to skip that entirely and give the FTC complete authority to pursue civil penalty. So at least in theory, although the president can name the chair of the FTC, the president doesn't get, at the moment anyway, can't just fire the FTC commissioners when he takes office. And so you could, in theory, have a situation where a holdover FTC brings an action for civil penalties for violating federal law that the chief law enforcement officer of the United States doesn't think is a legal violation. So I would say that's one more problematic aspect of the statute. And with that, why don't I hand it back to Brian and then to Matt.
Sure. And I do want to ask one question, either you can answer, Willie, or maybe Matt, you can weave these into your comments. I know we have, I mean, maybe this is evident for the administrative law experts on this call or in this webinar, but as a patent lawyer or as an antitrust lawyer, I mean, the idea that we see, you know, we see enhanced damages for willful infringement or inequitable conduct. We see up to treble damages in patent cases and RICO cases. Those are judge determinations. Those aren't, I mean, the jury may have some say in the underlying liability findings, or you know, we can go to copyright law where there's certain statutory damages set and the judge does her part in the computation as well. I think the proponents of this act would say that this fundamentally is not that different, but maybe, you know, maybe Matt, you can respond to what Willie said. And look, I'm sure you have clients on both sides of this issue, but kind of respond to, you know, is he reading Jarkissi too broadly? Is this statute savable? Are there changes that can be made? Or is it just something that this idea that Senator Cole began proposing in 2006 is finally going to rest it at the end of 2024?
Yeah, thanks, Brian, and to Willie as well for setting this up so well. Look, you know, we're in somewhat of the prediction business in terms of you know, advising our clients on what's likely to pass muster and what isn't. I agree with Willie that the act as currently constituted is. I don't think the six justice majority that signed on to Jarkissi would be impressed by a statute that says this, we're different than the SEC. All we do in the agency is make a binding determination on liability, and then we let you go to court with everything already decided on damages for the penalty. I think that's not likely to be responsive to the concerns that the court had in Jarkissi. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't different ways of doing it. You could imagine a statute that allows the agency to get a cease and desist order straight up, you know, through maybe expedited proceedings, you know, stop what's going on. But then it might have the right to file in court, but you would want the statute to make clear that the liability finding or really any finding on the merits or anything, particularly anything that would go to the quantum of relief, is not binding on the Article III tribunal. So you can imagine different ways of doing that. You know, just the very notion that an agency finding could even be preclusive in a federal court is something that I'm not sure all nine justices of this court would agree about in the first instance. I think Willie probably remembers a case he argued, and I believe won. He had Justice Thomas explaining that he had deep doubts about the appropriateness of allowing agency findings to be preclusive in a federal court. So, you know, starting from that perspective, I think it's pretty unlikely that that there would be five votes to say it's fine to have the liability finding imported into the Article III proceeding. So you could create a presumption. You know, the statute already has a presumption, meaning that the agreement is presumed to be anti-competitive unless certain things are present. I don't think it's necessarily problematic for an Article III court to decide liability and award penalties using that presumption, although that could be debated too. I think there's some due process questions that go along with that. But if this statute were to be reformed, the agency findings can't be an input into this, particularly a preclusive input into the Article III process. You would need to have some sort of cleavage between the two. Doesn't mean that the agency can't get an equitable relief or award itself equitable relief in the first instance, but that can't, I think there's a real Jarkissi problem, at least assuming that this is not the kind of public right that is excluded from it that Jarkissi was talking about. And it's especially the case, you know, talking about treble damages and that kind of thing. I mean, that just feels like, again, that's just Brian, maybe this is a little bit to your point, the kind of thing that I think the modern court, this court going forward, will say needs to be awarded by a jury. So I do think there's a problem. I do think under jurisprudence, the act as written is probably not going to fly. But you know, you could imagine other acts, you know, other approaches that would, you know, try to get around some of these problems.
Yeah, Brian, can I add a word?
Please do that. Yeah,
on that. So, Justice, those of you who were at the Scalia dinner on Thursday may have seen Justice Gorsuch talking about agencies and some of his peeves with agency regulation, and he took some time to bash the deferential standard of review for agency fact finding. You know, basically, it's to say, you know, like, a mere scintilla of evidence is enough for a court of appeals to uphold an agency fact finding. And so, although there is sort of there is a court in the process here, it's not as if the court gets to the court of appeals gets to second guess what the ALJ has decided factually and really about the pro-competitive justification of the of one of these settlements. And so I think, as Matt said, I think that really is going to give the court a lot of pause, because it touches a lot of the pain points that the current majority has with agency adjudication. And to look at the copyright or patent analogies, I mean, like, at least a jury has found infringement and may have made the factual finding of willfulness that can be one of the most important ingredients in a decision whether to enhance. And enhancement is also governed by, you know, by some boundary of discretion, where, and the same thing in copyright, statutory damages are, you know, a consequence of a jury's infringement finding. And the Supreme Court actually had a Seventh Amendment case about copyright statutory damages as well. They can go down through remitter. But it doesn't look like the same type of anywhere from zero to 3 billion that you have here.
So I want to make an observation. It seems like in order to fix this, I mean, it kind of would put us back to where we currently are under FTC v. Actavis. I'm going to ask Professor Morris to chime in on that. But I did just want to close the loop on one point that, Matt, you raised. You mentioned a couple of times the public rights exception. For those of us that are patent lawyers on this call, we all remember, I mean, that notion really came into our front and center during oil states when there were challenges to the authority of the PTAB back in maybe 2017, 6 or 7 years ago. Can you offer a view and a prediction on whether the public rights exception would have any weight here? Or is this just, you know, notwithstanding the fact that this is an agency action that deals with patent rights, it doesn't come into play? Do you have any thoughts on whether that is? And I know, you know, the Chief Justice said that it's a narrow exception. The court's not going to allow to continue metastasizing. But you know, can you close the loop on that? Then Professor Morris, if you want to kind of chime in, kind of bring us back to the bigger picture here of what is going on and whether this is even, you know, whether this is a solution in search of a problem.
Yeah, I think the patent question, public rights question, is an interesting one. I think there are a lot of agency and a lot of agency action that don't get off the starting blocks. They're not going to be public rights. Here, there's at least an argument going both ways about that. But I think I would be surprised, at least mildly surprised, if the court thought that what it was doing in jurisprudence allowed what was going on here because of the public rights nature of the of the dispute. Yes, there's patents involved, but ultimately it's anti-competitive conduct that's at issue. I haven't done an exhaustive search of the analogs, the common law, anti-competitive law, but I think that it would be a pretty big chunk out of jurisprudence if things like this were not encompassed within it. So I'd be surprised if it turned out to be exempt, but I'm interested if others on the panel have views about that.
Yeah, I can chime in on this. So in Oil States versus Green, the majority was very careful to distinguish what was going on with the PTAB proceedings, because they saw the PTAB proceedings basically as a continuation of what the PTO was already doing with examining patents and basically taking a second look at their previous decisions. And that it was purely about whether or not this public right was validly granted or not validly granted. But again, they were very careful to distinguish this from infringement. Right. And so PTAB proceedings cannot address patent infringement. The court said, you know, that's a question of liability. And so that's really something that does merit an Article III court and certainly falls under the Seventh Amendment. And so presumably, because the Preserve Access Act isn't about invalidating a patent or, you know, deciding whether or not the PTO validly granted the patent in the first place, it's more about, did you violate a statute? Did you violate some sort of legally established right, which is much more akin to patent infringement than it is to patent validity? So I would say that would be a valid grounds on which a court could say, yeah, we said patents are public rights to some extent, right? But that this particular public right exception doesn't apply here.
Does anyone have any further thoughts on the public on the public rights exception? Or it seems like we're all in alignment. Actually, I mean, it's not much of a debate, but we're all actually in alignment that this is, you know, at most the patents are collateral to the issue here. But
the Supreme Court in the activist case had the opportunity to adopt a test that would have like kind of made the validity of the patent kind of part of the antitrust case, but it didn't, right? It consciously rejected the idea of like the case within a case and made everything, shall we say, much more mushy. And I think as a result, like it's just it is basically just a standard case under the antitrust laws asserting that an agreement between two parties restrains competition in a way that Congress has prescribed as unlawful. And just like you couldn't take a Sherman Act case to an ALJ, I don't think you could describe this, especially pursuing civil penalties rather than just cease and desist relief, as a public right.
That's a good point too. I mean, that's always one of the things that's bothered me about the Actavis decision. I've been criticizing it since it came out in 2013, both for the mushiness of the decision, but also just how I think corrosive it is. I remember being involved in the Wellbutrin litigation 8 years ago now, just explaining how unrealistic the assumptions are in Actavis. But I think that could be a good pivot, Emily. If you can explain, I mean, I think you have some views on, is this really even a necessary piece of legislation, or is this just a problem that you know? Surely, I'll give credit to the bill sponsors. I think they're very well intentioned and thoughtful people. But is this a problem that just doesn't exist in the real world of pharmaceutical patent litigation and settlements?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, a lot's happened since 2006, and this bill in some form was originally proposed, and specifically with the Actavis decision from the Supreme Court majority. So although the Supreme Court majority in Actavis did not create a presumption, it didn't even apply kind of a quick look or intermediate scrutiny to these kinds of so-called reverse payment settlements, it did create what a lot of scholars have called the Actavis inference. So exactly as Willie was saying, you know, the court acknowledged it wouldn't be practical to try to decide patent validity within one of these challenges, these antitrust challenges to the reverse payment settlements. Instead, we can infer something, and I think this is what you and I both kind of have problems with. We can infer something about the likely validity or likely infringement of the patent at issue by the size of the payment from the brand name manufacturer to the generic. The idea being that the more weak the patent is, or the less likely it is infringed, the more that the brand name manufacturer is willing to pay to the generic. And there are a number of problems with this particular inference, but it's one that the FTC has taken very seriously. And so another holding that I find problematic with the Actavis decision is that the Supreme Court more or less expressly said, hey, look, there are really only two forms of settlement that are acceptable here and that are not anti-competitive. either the brand name manufacturer, again, offer only to pay for the generics litigation costs, which I think the FTC is now estimated to be somewhere around $700,000 or less, or, and this is what really overlaps with the Preserve Access Act, the brand name manufacturer can offer the generic to enter the market earlier than patent expiration. And that in particular, and this is what scholars call the probabilistic patent theory, that in particular, the weaker the patent, the earlier the generic should be allowed to enter. And the court didn't explain how we're supposed to decide whether the patent is weaker or, you know, less weak, and therefore whether or not the generic should enter earlier rather than later. But it did basically say, hey, look, that's the only way to settle these cases, either just pay for the litigation costs or allow them to enter early, which is effectively kind of a compulsory license. And it's a compulsory license that, you know, the antitrust world has applied in the past in merger cases. So it's not necessarily outside the pale in that regard. But it is one that really does shorten the effective patent life of a lot of these patents. And so what's happened is that the FTC requires that these cases submit their settlement terms to the FTC for review. And so the FTC has been keeping records of this. And the FTC, in a 2020 report reviewing, I think, settlements up until 2017, reported that the vast majority of settlements, some 95% of settlements by 2017, involved these kinds of early generic entry terms, right? Which is exactly one of the terms that the Preserve Access said would not be an antitrust violation. So 95% of these settlements already involve something that the Preserve Access Act finds not to be anti-competitive. And so it's quite likely that, and I think this is part of the reason why the FTC stopped publishing these reports, it's quite likely that the brand name and generic litigants are settling the cases according to the terms of the Preserve Access Act anyway. And in a lot of ways, what the FTC is already doing arguably skirts kind of the limitations on jargassy, right? Because they're basically saying we get to review these settlement terms. If we think the settlement terms are anti-competitive, you know, we have the right to bring a case against you, which will be heard in an Article III court. And so rather than face the possibility of litigation from the FTC, especially under the terms, rather restrictive terms set forth in Actavis, these litigants are presumably saying, hey, look, we'll just go ahead and settle the case with the way that you want us to settle the case. Everybody wins, right? Or at least to some extent wins. We get to keep our patent, but the generic gets to enter early, and therefore we have pro-competitive effects that surely at least outweigh any anti-competitive effects. And so, you know, there's some other issues, again, with this kind of Actavis inference and this kind of probabilistic patent approach to these settlements. But overall, the effect has already been what the Preserve Access Act was presumably hoping to accomplish.
So it sounds like then that it not only would this, I mean, setting aside the jargassy issues, it sounds like that the carve out here in the act would be so large just because this is the way that drug makers have been doing settlements since Actavis came down in 2013, that it's really not going to have its intended impact and most of the settlements has a pro-competitive rationale if you're getting good antitrust advice on how to structure your settlements.
Yeah. And so the treble damages under the Preserve Access Act, you know, really would be at most kind of suspenders to what's already a pretty effective belt. And so I think it would just give the litigants even more incentive to avoid anything that might look like it's an anti-competitive settlement. Why do we need, you know, the suspenders in addition to a belt that seems to be working pretty well at the moment?
Right. Yeah, and I should mention we have the floor is open for Q&A if anyone has any questions. But Matt or Willie, do you want to respond to anything that Professor Morris said? Otherwise, I'll just make one more point, and then we can give everyone a call a few minutes of their morning back. But do you have anything you want to say in response to Professor Morris?
Plus one.
Yeah, exactly. If you've got legitimate suspenders, don't have an unconstitutional belt. That's what I would say.
Now that's a good mixed metaphor. Now, Professor, I do want to mention one. I know we may have glossed over this, but I think one of the carve outs in the Preserve Access Act is that if you can make a payment that's specifically for legal fees, but up to $7.5 million adjusted for inflation, I guess just like the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act. I'm not sure which cases get those types of budgets anymore, but that's neither here nor there. But you made an earlier comment that the generics can make a risk-free and lucrative filing, and we don't need to quibble about that right now. I think there is a bit more to that, both in terms of the regulatory cost of making your ANDA filing, but also the legal fees. But it seems like if the settlement is structured for legal payments, well, then they've already said there's no anti-competitive effect either. So that's another reason why it seems like under your through your lens that this legislation just doesn't go anywhere. Like what's the point of it? So
yeah, exactly. And so you think about cases in which a generic would be willing to accept a payment just for their litigation costs. Right. And that the only instance in which they'd be willing to do that is when it's clear that they're going to lose the case. And so they just as soon save themselves the litigation costs. And those cases may be relatively frequent. I'm not sure. And I don't know that the FTC has kept data on those particular cases. But given that it's never completely clear that a patent is valid, right? There's always a potential chance that a jury, right, would find a patent invalid or infringed. That there's always a small chance that the generic will win, right? And I've heard it cited to me that anytime these patents come to litigation, there's up to a 25% chance, no matter how solid the patent is and how likely valid it is, there's always a 25% chance that somebody will be convinced that something along the way makes the patent invalid. And so the generics, it's always worth their while to bring these cases, right? And in fact, so many of the cases, or not even cases, but so many times when the generic files what's called a paragraph 4 certification, and that's kind of the trigger for these cases, and also triggers kind of the protective measures for the generics that allow them to bring these cases risk-free, that a significant number of these paragraph 4 challenges or certifications go unchallenged by the brand name patent holders, that they don't file a patent infringement suit, and that they basically just say, yeah, we're not going to challenge the FDA's approval of this particular generic based on these particular patents. And so, again, I don't know that it's necessary for the government to step in with yet another statute that regulates this kind of behavior.
Right. Great. Well, thank you everyone for these thoughts. It doesn't look like we have any questions in the queue, but I think as you can tell, all four of us are very passionate about these issues. I'm sure I'd be happy to speak offline if you have questions later. But otherwise, I just want to thank our panelists this morning for their time and their expertise on this important piece of legislation, which I think we'll all be interestingly watching to see if it does move forward either in the lame duck session of this Congress or if it comes much like the Phoenix, it rises again in the next Congress. So thank you all for your time today. And thank you, Edith, for facilitating today's program.
Yes, and on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Matt, Willie, and Professor Morris for speaking with us today, and to Brian for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and your comments. Thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate you attending. You can stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.